Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.20, The Ottoman Freedom Society. Over the past several episodes, we've been covering the years directly following the First Congress of the Ottoman Opposition. And these 3 years, from 1902 to 1905, were eventful, to say the least. In 1903, widespread chaos gripped the Ottoman Balkans, starting with the Salonika bombing campaign of the boatmen, and on through the mass revolt of Macedonian Christians in the Ilinden Uprising. Then, in 1904, over on the other side of the empire, Armenian Fedayi guerrillas battled the Ottoman Fourth Army in eastern Anatolia. And finally, in 1905, Armenian Dashnaks nearly succeeded in assassinating Sultan Abdulhamid at the Hamidiye Mosque. So, in the big picture, these 3 years were marked by a dramatic increase in the level of insurrectionary activity within the Ottoman Empire, whether it be popular uprisings out in the rural borderlands of Macedonia and eastern Anatolia, or anarchist terrorist attacks in the empire's major cities from Salonika to Istanbul. But all of this drama only covers what had been happening within the Ottoman Empire domestically. And boy, let me tell you, a whole lot has been happening out in the wider world on the international scene. And these developments outside of the empire would also play a major role in driving events towards the revolution of 1908. Because in the broader picture, the Young Turk Revolution would simply be the last revolution to take place in what can be thought of as a cascade of revolutions that would sweep across Eastern Europe and Western Asia. Starting in 1905, the Russian Empire had been rocked by widespread revolutionary unrest in an event that would come to be known to history as the Russian Revolution of 1905. And the reason that this event has a specific year attached to it is because this is not the revolution of 1917 that would bring the Bolsheviks to power and inaugurate Soviet rule. But even though the Russian Revolution of 1905 is much less famous than that of 1917, it was no less dramatic, as 1905 was marked by army mutinies, labor unrest, a general strike, and widespread popular revolts amongst the peasantry. This unrest would include some of the most famous revolutionary moments in history, with events such as Bloody Sunday and the mutiny on the battleship Potemkin. This year of revolution in Russia would eventually force Tsar Nicholas to proclaim a constitution in 1906. And with the inaugural meeting of the Russian Parliament in spring 1906, the absolute monarchy of the Russian Empire, which had been the law of the land in Russia for about 300 years, was brought to an abrupt end and replaced by a constitutional regime in which the Tsar was forced to share power with a legislature. Now, if you know anything about the Russian Revolution, you know that Tsar Nicholas would try his darndest to snatch power back from the parliamentary forces that had been unleashed in his empire. However, seeing as there were two Russian revolutions, this would obviously backfire. So, even though the Russian Revolution of 1905 is often overshadowed by the 1917 revolution of Lenin and the Bolsheviks, for those living through these events, the 1905 revolution in Russia was truly an earth-shattering event. For centuries, Russia had been the conservative bulwark upholding the old order in Europe, as the Russian Tsar had bailed out the old dynasties of Europe on countless occasions, running from the Napoleonic Wars on through the revolutions of 1848 and beyond. So, the Russian Revolution of 1905 was a super big deal, because it meant that one of the longest-lasting and most conservative monarchies in old Europe had been seriously weakened and nearly toppled. Later that very same year, in December of 1905, widespread popular unrest would also break out in the Persian Qajar Empire. And after a year of revolution, a constitution would also be implemented in Persia in August of 1906, just a month after the ratification of the Russian constitution. The Russian and Persian empires were very tightly linked to the Ottoman Empire. As we saw in our series on the Armenian resistance, People, weapons, money, goods, and ideas were constantly crisscrossing the nexus of borders out in eastern Anatolia, where the Ottoman, Persian, and Russian empires met. So the constitutional revolutions in Russia and in Persia hit very close to home in the Ottoman Empire. Because even though the Russian and Persian empires were the historic rivals of the Ottomans, both were similarly old world empires, and both were now seemingly being swept into the dustbin of history. Like the Ottoman Empire, the Russian Empire had long been a diverse, multi-ethnic, land-based empire ruled by an autocratic monarch and backed by a conservative elite. And then the Persian Empire was the other great Islamic empire alongside the Ottoman Empire, with the Persians leading the Shia world and the Ottomans leading the Sunni world. So 1905 was quite a distressing year for Sultan Abdul Hamid and his government, as his fellow absolute monarchs out on the eastern border were now getting pushed around by their rebellious subjects. And while all this was going down, the Sultan had nearly been assassinated in July during the Yildiz bombing, which reminded Abdul Hamid that he was not at all immune to the sort of revolutionary unrest happening in Russia and Persia. So Abdul Hamid's paranoia was now reaching a truly critical level, and the Sultan would respond with his usual coterie of repressive measures as he intensified censorship, expanded his spy network, further increased the presence of his secret police, and cracked down on political opposition as he began to arrest and exile not only political radicals, but now even the most conservative voices pushing for reform. As is so often the case, this generalized crackdown on all oppositional elements would have the effect of pushing more and more people to join the radical opposition. People who would not necessarily have resorted to revolutionary tactics had they been treated with a bit more clemency. So, as chaos grips the borderlands of the empire, and as the great powers continue to dictate terms to Abdul Hamid, and as the Sultan cracks down on his subjects through repressive measures that were increasingly arbitrary, a general feeling of desperation would spread throughout the empire, a sort of apocalyptic feeling that the end of times was quickly approaching and that radical action needed to be taken immediately if the Ottoman Empire was going to be saved. So, this would be the general apocalyptic atmosphere animating a new generation of young Muslims who had simply had enough. And increasingly, young patriotic Muslims would begin to form secret societies within the empire itself. And these patriots would begin to talk more openly about making a revolution that could reinvigorate the empire and save it from imminent collapse. The two men who would end up emerging from this world of apocalyptic conspiracy as the revolution's most powerful and influential figures would be Talat Pasha and Mustafa Kemal, the future Ataturk. Both Talat and Ataturk would begin their political careers around 1905 as they form secret societies in opposition to Abdul Hamid. Now, before we go any further, it is important to note that most historians now agree on the fact that Mustafa Kemal did not play a major role leading up to, during, or directly following the revolution. So yes, Ataturk, who will go on to establish the Turkish Republic in 1923, and who is one of those rare figures in history who would kind of single-handedly define the future course of the Turkish nation-state, would not be all that important until World War I. It's one of those things where, because Ataturk would end up being so incredibly influential later on, that it's easy to assume that he must have played a major role in the Revolution of 1908 itself. But even though he would take part in the revolution, and he was definitely a member of this revolutionary generation, our interest in him stems almost entirely from his future importance. So we are going to keep tabs on Mustafa Kemal, not because of his importance to the revolution of 1908, because honestly, he wasn't that important, but instead because he will be so important later on. All of that is to say that most historians now agree that Mustafa Kemal was a rather minor figure in the Revolution of 1908, especially when compared with other people who might be less famous now, but who were much more influential on the course of events leading up to and following the revolution. One such figure is Talat Pasha, to whom we will now turn our attention. Of all the people whose careers would be made by the revolution, Talat's rise to power is probably the most remarkable, as he will, over a period of about 10 years, go from being essentially a mailman to being the de facto dictator of the Ottoman Empire. So it is time to finally put Talat Pasha, the man who will lead the empire through to its final collapse and who is often described as one of the primary architects of the Armenian genocide, onto the board. Mehmed Talat, he would later become a pasha, was born in 1874 in the city of Edirne, historically called Adrianople, which is about 150 miles, 250 kilometers west of Istanbul in southern Thrace, that area of the Balkans where the borders of modern Greece, Bulgaria, and Turkey all meet. Talat's father was from the town of Karjali, which itself lies in the southeastern part of the Rhodope Mountains. Today, Karjali is in southern Bulgaria, but when Mehmed Talat was born, it had for centuries been a part of Ottoman Rumelia, that is, before the great powers at the Congress of Berlin created the autonomous province of Eastern Rumelia, which would then be annexed into the Bulgarian Principality in 1885. What all of this means is that, like so many of his other Muslim comrades from the Balkans, Talat would be greatly affected at a young age by the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78, and by the trauma of having his homeland be conquered by an invading Russian army. Because the three-year-old Talat and his family would be forced to flee their home in Edirne and to escape to Istanbul when the Russian army occupied Thrace. Talat's family would be allowed to return home a year later, after Edirne was left within the Ottoman Empire. But as we have said many, many times on this podcast, for the Muslims living in the Balkans, which there were millions of, the liberation of the Balkan nation-states in 1878 was not experienced as a liberation, but instead as a catastrophic war of conquest and a traumatic refugee crisis. The Muslims who fled the violent onslaught of the Russian Imperial Army would become known as the Muhajir, which is simply the Turkish and Arabic word for migrant. In this context, Muhajir specifically refers to the 5 to 7 million Muslim refugees who would flee the former Ottoman Balkans throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. So Mehmed Talat's family were Muhajir refugees who fled their home in southern Thrace after it was occupied by the Russian army. This anti-Muslim violence experienced at a young age would stamp Talat's politics and lead him to develop a stubborn pride in being a Turkish-speaking Muslim from Europe. This Ottoman Muslim patriotism would always be wrapped up with a certain level of resentment towards the Orthodox Christians who had displaced Turkish Muslims during the Russian War of Conquest. As we will see, Talat Pasha would share these feelings of prideful resentment with many of his other revolutionary comrades, the most notable being Bahattin Shakir, who we will introduce next episode and who was similarly displaced as a young boy. Talat's generation of Balkan Muslims would all share a keen sense of spiritual homelessness due to the fact that their fatherland, Ottoman Rumelia, or Ottoman Europe, had been taken over by the invading Russians and by the emergent Christian nation-states of the Balkans. Another experience that Talat would share with many of his future revolutionary comrades was the early loss of his father, who would die when Talat was only 11 years old. As the only male in his family, Talat was forced to grow up quite fast after his father's death, and he would have to support his family as a teenager. While growing up in Edirne, Talat was described as charming and yet also quite gruff, some might even say brutal, and he would be expelled from military school at the age of 16 for assaulting one of his teachers. And after being expelled from school, Talat found work as an assistant at a post office, and he also began to teach Turkish at an international Jewish school. While teaching at this school, Talat would begin his journey as a self-taught polyglot, learning French while at work. In later years, Talat would also teach himself Greek, Bulgarian, and even Judeo-Spanish. As a young man, Talat was very taken by the revolutionary and patriotic discourses emerging in the 1890s in opposition to Sultan Abdulhamid. When Talat was in his early 20s, he became involved in a conspiratorial group of low-ranking bureaucrats who were not directly connected to the Committee of Union and Progress, but who did circulate their literature. So, like most of the other oppositional groups of the 1890s, Talat's group would be rooted out and destroyed in the Sultan's sweep of arrests in 1896. However, because this group was only distantly connected to the CUP center in Istanbul, the conspirators were mostly just exiled internally as opposed to the CUP founders who were forced to move abroad. Talat would spend about a year and a half in prison, which is where he learned Bulgarian and Greek from fellow inmates. And then when Talat was released in 1898, he was exiled to Salonika. Now, why the government thought that it would be a good idea to send these conspiratorial youths to Salonika, the heart of revolutionary conspiracy, I do not know. But Talat was sent to Salonika, and so he would set up shop in the heart of revolutionary conspiracy. While living in Salonika, Talat would eventually find work in the Ottoman postal service. And for years, he was essentially a revolutionary mailman, as he delivered mail by day, and then by night, he immersed himself in the clandestine, subversive activities of Salonika. In 1901, Talat began to correspond with Ahmed Reza and his circle in Paris. And the young Turk leader, Reza, began to ask Talat if he thought it would be possible to build an oppositional party in Macedonia. At first, Talat was a bit pessimistic about the prospect of recruiting fellow Muslims because, as we've mentioned before, secret revolutionary groups were typically viewed by Muslims as an exclusively Christian thing. Through our series on the Macedonian struggle, we have talked at length about the extraordinary number of Christian revolutionary organizations which operated in Macedonia, such as the Supremacist based in Bulgaria, the Ethniki Etairia based in Greece, and the Macedonian Revolutionary Organization based in Salonika. All of these groups developed widespread conspiratorial networks that organized guerrilla bands in the countryside, spread revolutionary literature amongst peasants and workers, and carried out terrorist attacks in the urban centers. Patriotic Muslims like Talat would develop an interesting and complex relationship with these Christian revolutionary groups. Because, on the one hand, Talat and his comrades saw these groups as pushing the interests of the Balkan nation-states at the expense of the Ottoman Empire, which, as we know, was very much a lot of times the case, though it was not always this simple, especially within the MRO. As a proud Ottoman Muslim, Talat obviously resented the fact that these clandestine groups were pretty much trying to overthrow the Ottoman state, annex Macedonia into either Greece, Bulgaria, or Serbia, and in the process, drive out all Ottoman Muslims from the Balkans. Talat had grown up as a Muhajir refugee, so this prospect of being displaced was not abstract. It was a very real threat. But along with this resentment, there was also a certain level of admiration, you might even call it jealousy, of the intense dedication and patriotic resolve shown by Christian revolutionaries. Talat and other Muslims who similarly opposed Sultan Abdulhamid were often in awe of the sheer fearlessness of the MRO and the Dashnaks and of their members' willingness to sacrifice their own well-being for the betterment of their people. As conditions in the Ottoman Empire became more and more desperate moving into the 20th century, patriotic Ottoman Muslims would begin to turn towards radical revolutionary politics, and they would largely model their secret societies off of Christian revolutionary groups. And because of the insane number of such Christian revolutionary groups operating throughout Macedonia, Salonika, Macedonia's largest city, would emerge as the heart of revolutionary conspiracy amongst these patriotic Muslims, who felt that Abdulhamid was single-handedly driving the empire into the ground. the radicalization of Muslims living in Salonika would greatly accelerate in 1903 as a result of the mass chaos unleashed first with the bombing campaign of the boatmen and then later with the massive Alinden uprising. Because as a result of the violent chaos in Macedonia, the great powers began to reopen the Macedonian question and to more openly discuss what might need to be done about Ottoman rule in Europe. These discussions would culminate in the so-called Mersteg Agreement, in which Russia and Austria-Hungary forced the Ottomans to enact certain reforms as a result of the popular unrest witnessed during the Alinden Uprising. The most important aspect of these reforms was that special advisors from each of the great powers were to be appointed to help administer different regions of Macedonia. The presence of these arrogant and chauvinistic European advisors would create a ton of resentment amongst proud Ottoman Muslims living in the Balkans. This resentment towards the great powers would become most pronounced within the ranks of the Third Army of Macedonia, as Ottoman officers now had to deal with these sharply dressed and patronizing Europeans, who had essentially just waltzed right in and started ordering everyone around without the slightest knowledge of local politics. So, with apocalyptic chaos gripping the Balkans, and with the great powers beginning to conspire once more, it became clear that something dramatic needed to happen if Macedonia was going to be saved from going the way of Crete, Egypt, Bulgaria, Serbia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina, which had all similarly experienced popular uprisings, most of which were actually much smaller than the Alinden Uprising. And as a direct result of these uprisings, these Ottoman provinces had either gained their independence or been taken over by an imperialistic great power. Then, on top of all of this, it's not like these European advisors did anything remotely helpful in terms of restoring order, as the Macedonian struggle would only further intensify and become more bitter in the years following the Alinden Uprising. And so, not only were these arrogant European officers roaming around, but now the Christian revolutionary groups like the MRO were also hyper-visible, which again inspired both fear and resentment, as well as awe and admiration amongst patriotic Muslims wanting to save their empire. So, in 1903, Mehmed Talat, who had recently been promoted to chief clerk at the post office, would begin to step up his revolutionary activity pretty dramatically. That year, Talat began meeting with a group of like-minded patriots, and they would discuss what needed to be done to save their fatherland. At first, these meetings were pretty casual, taking place at a local bar or a public park. But as they got more organized, the revolutionaries began joining secret brotherhoods so that they could discuss more openly. The most notable of these sorts of secret brotherhoods were the Salonika Freemason Lodge, Macedonia Resorta, as well as the Sufi Bektashi Lodges. We've already discussed the importance of Freemasonry at some length, as we noted how Freemason Lodges played an important role in the 1876 coup of Midhat Pasha and the young Ottomans, as well as in Urabi's revolt down in Egypt. And well, Freemasonry continued to be super important as a revolutionary incubator leading up to 1908, and Talat was initiated into the Macedonia Resorta Freemason Lodge in 1903, and in a few years' time, he would become the society's first Grand Master. In addition to Freemasonry, the Bektashi Sufi Order was also super important for the Young Turk revolutionaries. To put things quite simply for now, Sufism is the mystical branch of Islam, and the Bektashi were historically one of the most influential Sufi brotherhoods in the Ottoman Empire. This influence surrounded the old Janissaries, as for centuries the Bektashis were the official Sufi order of the Janissary Corps, that elite military unit which historically held a ton of sway over Ottoman politics. But when Sultan Mahmud II did away with the Janissaries in 1826 in the so-called Auspicious Incident, he also banned the Bektashi order. However, this did not mean that the Bektashis ceased to exist, but rather that their organization went underground and became more secret and more conspiratorial. So, like the Freemasons, the Bektashis would emerge as yet another important space for oppositional politics to germinate. And in Salonika specifically, Bektashi lodges and Freemason lodges both became important meeting places for Muslim revolutionaries. Talat, along with being a Freemason, was also a member of the Bektashis. Over the next 3 or so years, Talat and a few other comrades in Salonika would meet at their Bektashi or Freemason lodges to share common grievances and to plot how they might be able to save Macedonia. Within Talat's inner circle in Salonika, there were a good many people who would go on to have important roles after the revolution. And I want to go ahead and mention one of these individuals in particular, the economist and future minister of finance, Mehmed Javid. Talat and his friend Javid would become two of the most important figures in solidifying the rule of the CUP directly following the overthrow of Sultan Abdulhamid in 1909, as these two comrades from Salonika would be the first CUP members to attain formal appointments as government ministers. Talat would become the Minister of the Interior and Javid the Minister of Finance. So Talat and Javid would be some of the first people to formalize CUP rule over the Ottoman Empire. Mehmed Javid was born in Salonika in 1875 to a family of influential Dunmeys. Now, we have mentioned the Dunme in passing, but now is as good a time as any to go ahead and fully introduce them, because the Dunme will play an important, if at times mysterious, role in the revolution of 1908. Mehmed Javid was a Dunme, and so now it is time for a quick tangent into the history of the Dunme. The word Dunme means to turn or to convert. And at the most basic level, the Dunme were a Jewish community who converted en masse from Judaism to Sunni Islam in the 17th century. This is why the Dunme are often described as secret or crypto-Jews, which is a description that is 100% wrapped up in anti-Semitism, because practically speaking, the Dunme were simply a countercultural community of Sunni Muslims. But where this idea of the Dunme being secret Jews comes from goes back to the Dunme's original leader, a messianic figure from the 17th century named Sabbatai Zevi. In the mid-1600s, there was a growing belief amongst many Ottoman Jews that the Messiah was going to arrive any day now. And interestingly, this messianic belief surrounded the rise of the Ottoman Empire, as many Jews saw the Ottoman conquest of Byzantium as an early sign of the upcoming salvation of the Jews, because the arrival of the Ottomans was hailed by Jews as a pretty awesome development. The Ottoman conquest of Constantinople ended the dominance of the Greek Patriarchate and its policy of exclusion of all non-Orthodox communities. So, as had been the case for the Armenian Church, the Jews were also given official status under the millet system, and many Jews began to see these positive developments under Ottoman rule as pointing towards a future salvation. In Salonika in particular, many Jews began to migrate to the Macedonian city during the Spanish Inquisition, as the Ottoman Empire was much more welcoming of religious minorities than was Spain and Portugal. As we have mentioned, this influx of Jews from the Iberian Peninsula during the Spanish Inquisition led Salonika to become the home of the Sephardic Jews. And really, Salonika became the heart of the entire Jewish community in all of Europe, as Sephardic Jews came to represent the majority of the population in Salonika and they dominated the city culturally. In Salonika, and really throughout all Ottoman Jewry, this belief in the coming of the Messiah was percolating when along came a charismatic and eccentric rabbi named Sabbatai Zevi, who began claiming that he himself was in fact this long-promised Messiah. And tons of people quickly hopped on board. Now, Sabbatai Zevi's popularity did not only stem from his claim to being the Messiah, but also grew out of the fact that he challenged conventional religious and social norms in a way that many found quite refreshing. And he specifically challenged gender relations, and many women were important public figures within his movement. And looking ahead a little bit, this liberal outlook of Sabbatai Zevi and his followers would continue to define the later Dunmei communities, and this would lead the Dunmei to become an important counter-cultural force in the empire. This was one of the reasons why young Turks like Talat would see the Dunmei as natural allies. Anyways, when Sabbatai Zevi began to garner a huge following in the 1600s, the Sultan did not respond by immediately repressing the movement. Instead, the Sultan invited, or really ordered, Sabbatai Zevi to meet with him at Topkapi Palace. And then the Sultan offered this alleged messiah a choice. Either he would allow his Janissaries to fire upon him so that he could show the world his true identity as the Messiah by stopping the bullets, or he could convert to Islam. And well, Sabbatai Zevi was not really trying to die, so he chose the latter option and converted to Islam. And while many Jews turned away from Sabbatai Zevi after this conversion, many more stuck with their Messiah and followed him on his religious journey, as hundreds of his Jewish disciples also converted to Islam. Sabbatai Zevi had originally cultivated one of his biggest followings amongst the Sephardic Jewish community of Salonika. And in the subsequent decades, Sabbatai Zevi's brother-in-law, who was a native of Salonika, would claim to be Sabbatai Zevi's successor, and he would keep the movement alive in the Macedonian city. And thereafter, this community within Salonika would come to be known by outsiders as the Dunmei, which again simply means to turn or to convert, in reference to the group's mass conversion from Judaism to Islam. Even though they had all allegedly converted to Islam, the Dunmei would secretly continue a lot of their Jewish practices and maintain a Jewish culture. Because of this, in future years, the Dunmei would come to be the subject of many anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that viewed the community as secret Jews. But the Dunmei honestly morphed into something that was neither Muslim nor Jewish, but yet still incorporated many elements and practices from both religions. For centuries, the Dunmei acted as an important bridge between the Muslim and Jewish communities of Salonika, and they helped to facilitate a sort of symbiotic relationship between the Sephardic Jews and the Turkish Muslims of the city, as both communities used their mutual connection to the Dunmei to prosper economically, socially, and politically. By the 20th century, the Dunmei community had emerged as one of the most powerful communities in Salonika, and they would become especially important in establishing schools in the city. With their countercultural bent, these Dunmei schools put a focus on critical free thinking and were generally defined by a liberal attitude towards education that greatly contrasted with the Islamic fundamentalism so prominent in more traditional schools. Several young Turks, including Mustafa Kemal, the future Ataturk, would receive their education in Dunmei schools and be influenced by their secular and liberal approach to education. So, with that long-winded backdrop, we now return to Mehmed Javid, who was a Dunmei from Salonika. Growing up, Javid attended the same Dunmei school that Mustafa Kemal would attend a few years later. After graduating from this liberal Dunmei school, Javed studied economics in Istanbul and proved himself to be quite gifted, earning an important role as a civil servant. Then, after working for a few years in Istanbul teaching economics and working at the Ministry of Education, Javed moved back to Salonika in the early 1900s. And it was during this time that Javed became friends with Mehmed Talat. And Javed was a part of the same conspiratorial circle as Talat. Javed would be an important connection for these future revolutionaries because influential leaders in the Dunmei community would allow Talat and his comrades to use their homes to hold secret meetings. And when the Sultan's secret police inevitably came knocking, Dunmei leaders would also open up their homes as safe houses for revolutionaries. So, for years, Talat, Javed, and their comrades continued to meet in Freemason or Bektashi lodges or in the homes of Dunmei leaders. But these patriotic Muslims increasingly began to feel the need to more fully organize their efforts, and they would begin to form their own secret revolutionary societies. And it is within this context that Mustafa Kemal, the future Ataturk, enters our story, as he would be one of the very first Muslims of his generation to form one of these secret societies. Mustafa Kemal had been born in Salonika in 1881, and like we have said, he attended a Donme school. This fact has fueled a lot of conspiracies about Ataturk himself being a secret Jew, trying to destroy the Muslim Ottoman Empire as part of a widespread Jewish Masonic conspiracy. And there has been a ton of debate amongst historians about Ataturk's ethnic heritage. I am not here to offer any final judgment on this debate, but most do agree that Mustafa Kemal was not a Donme, but instead he was, much like Talat, a Turkish-speaking Muslim with a mixed ethnic heritage, something that was very common for Muslims living in the Balkans. But Mustafa Kemal did attend a Donme school, and this early exposure to a liberal secular education definitely stamped Kemal's future politics. When Kemal was 7 years old, he, also like Talat, lost his father, and so Kemal would similarly have to grow up quite fast. When Kemal was just a preteen, he allegedly took the entrance exam for military school without consulting his mother. And in 1896, he enrolled at the Monastir Military Academy, and eventually he would attend the Istanbul War College. While in school, Mustafa Kemal both excelled in his studies and became heavily involved in seditious activity, which was rapidly growing within the ranks of the Ottoman military, especially amongst young junior army officers. And another junior officer who was one of Kemal's classmates was the charismatic and intrepid İsmail Enver. Now, we are going to more fully introduce Enver, future Minister of War, in a couple of episodes. But for now, we should just note that both Mustafa Kemal and Enver were involved in seditious activity as young cadets at the Istanbul Military Academy. And at this point, Kemal was largely overshadowed by the larger-than-life Enver. Upon graduation, Mustafa Kemal would be quite jealous of Enver's posting to the Third Army of Macedonia, because Kemal had been posted to the Fifth Army stationed in Damascus. Kemal viewed this posting to Syria as akin to being exiled. But even so, while in Damascus, the young Ataturk would continue to plot against the Sultan, and he would form a secret committee called the Fatherland and Freedom Society in 1905. Shortly after founding this committee, Kemal actually traveled back home to Salonika, allegedly due to health issues. However, once he arrived home, he began to just ask his superior officers stationed in Macedonia to please, please transfer him to the Third Army. Kemal could sense that things were clearly heating up in Macedonia following the Ilinden Uprising, and he didn't want to miss out on the action. During his four-month leave in Salonika, Kemal continued to recruit members into his Fatherland and Freedom Society. And though Talat and Javed did not join Ataturk's early group, the recruits that Mustafa Kemal did bring in were very much a part of the same circle of patriotic Muslims conspiring against Abdulhamid in the homes of influential Donme or at Freemason and Bektashi lodges. Even though there were a lot of sympathetic officers in the Third Army of Macedonia, the presence of Mustafa Kemal in Salonika inevitably came to the attention of the Sultan's secret police. So, at the end of Kemal's leave, he was forced to move back to his station in the Middle East. And though the young Kemal would be very disappointed by this, and by the fact that he would miss out on a lot of the developments leading up to 1908, in the long run, the fact that Kemal was not a part of the central conspiracy of Young Turks would allow him to distance himself from the Young Turk leaders like Talat once the empire collapsed at the end of World War I. But for the time being, the fact that Mustafa Kemal got sent away from Salonika meant that he would be overshadowed by other figures leading up to and following 1908. Such figures would include Kemal's rival, Enver, as well as Talat, who was beginning to emerge as the real center of gravity within the revolutionary scene in Salonika. And in September of 1906, Talat and a handful of his comrades decided to officially organize their own secret committee. It has been argued that Talat's committee was likely inspired by Mustafa Kemal's Fatherland and Freedom Society. And though evidence for this is inconclusive, the former members of Kemal's group would join Talat's group after Kemal had been sent back to Damascus. So there was at least some sort of loose connection with Kemal's earlier group. At a meeting held on September the 18th, 1906, Talat and his comrades created a new committee that they would dub the Ottoman Freedom Society. This committee, under the leadership of Talat, would, from this point on, emerge as the central revolutionary body operating within the empire itself. Throughout the rest of 1906 and into 1907, Talat, Javed, and others in the society aggressively recruited members into their new group. And because of the heightened atmosphere in Macedonia following the Ilinden uprising, and the increasing presence of great power administrators seemingly threatening annexation, the Ottoman Freedom Society would quickly grow in size. The group would model their organization off of Christian revolutionary groups like the MRO, and they would also borrow a lot of the conspiratorial imagery and, like, spooky initiation ceremonies from Freemason and Bektashi lodges. For example, new members were forced to undergo an extensive secret ritual in which Talat and other leaders would don red cloaks and lead new recruits blindfolded into a darkened room with candles. Then a master of ceremony wearing a scary mask would recite the ideals of the society and tell new members that the price of betraying them was death. Finally, recruits would place one hand on the Quran, or on a Bible or Torah for non-Muslims, and the other hand was placed on a pistol. And then they would recite an oath of loyalty. Once initiated, members were given passwords for entering the committee's lodges and told ways that they could help the cause. The society also had a secret hierarchical structure in which initiates only knew a handful of other members, meetings of more than five people were strictly forbidden, and the leaders of the committee were a tightly held secret. These measures were taken in order to avoid infiltration from the Sultan's secret police, who were everywhere at this point. Due to the general feeling of apocalypse in the Ottoman Balkans and the growing fear that the unrest in Macedonia would inevitably lead the great powers to turn Macedonia into another colonial satellite, the Ottoman Freedom Society rapidly grew in size. And critically, the society was perhaps most successful in recruiting young junior army officers and young military doctors in the Third Army of Macedonia, including future leaders of the revolution like Ismail Enver and Ahmed Jamal, but more on Enver and Jamal in a couple episodes. Many of the early members of the Ottoman Freedom Society would go on to be elected to the Ottoman Parliament following 1908, and many would also continue to play important roles in the Turkish Republic under Mustafa Kemal following World War I. To give you an idea of the general profile of these early members, and in case you want to look more into these early figures who lay a bit beyond our current narrative, some of the most important people were the director of the municipal hospital in Salonika, Dr. Mithat Shukru, also known as Bleda, the wealthy businessman and Salonikan aristocrat Mustafa Rami, also known as Arslan, First Lieutenants Ismail Kanbolad and Omer Nachi, instructors at the Salonika Military High School, Major Naki Bey and Major Bursali Mehmet Tahir, and finally Emmanuel Carrasco, a prominent lawyer and member of an elite Sephardic Jewish family in Salonika, who together with the Donme economist Mehmet Javid, demonstrate how the society was not an exclusively Sunni Muslim organization, though admittedly Christians were pretty rare. Mehmed Talat would thrive as an early leader of the Ottoman Freedom Society, and he would prove himself to be a master committee man, or komiteci, as they would come to be known in Turkish. And even though Talat was a civilian, he would become widely respected by the military men of the society who admired Talat's legendary bravery, which at times verged on recklessness, as he never hesitated to put his own life at risk for the good of the cause. So, through his charisma, bravery, and mastery of committee politics, Talat would eventually become the center of gravity in the revolutionary scene of Salonika. And what we are seeing here in 1906 and 1907 is the emergence of what would come to be referred to as the Sacred Committee, which would become the nucleus of the 1908 revolution, and which would continue to play a critical role in the years after the revolution. This Sacred Committee, which Talat was one of the most powerful members of, would eventually take over the Committee of Union and Progress. And the leaders of this Sacred Committee in Salonika would eventually come to have a fanatical, and you might even call it spiritual, authority over lower-ranking members of the CUP, who all looked up to the committeemen in Salonika. As we will see, once the CUP begins to grow exponentially following 1908 through the old bandwagon effect, the Sacred Committee would emerge as the real center of power in the empire, acting as the command center for the CUP branches scattered throughout Ottoman lands. And following the revolution, Mehmed Talat would continue to lead the Sacred Committee. And critically, he would also come to hold important positions within the Ottoman parliament and eventually within the administration as well. Talat's presence in both the Sacred Committee and in the Ottoman government would place him in a uniquely powerful position and set the stage for his de facto dictatorship by 1913. But in early 1907, the Ottoman Freedom Society was still mostly limited to the Balkan Peninsula, and its influence generally lessened the farther away you got from Salonika. But all of this would change when Talat and the Sacred Committee began to coordinate more formally with the Young Turks operating in exile, specifically Ahmed Riza, Dr. Nazim, and most importantly, Dr. Bahadin Shakir, who we will introduce next week, and who was currently in the process of completely reorganizing the CUP and reorienting their program towards a more activist, revolutionary platform. The Young Turks in Exile, under the new leadership of Dr. Shakir, would provide Talat and the Ottoman Freedom Society with a much clearer ideological program and offer them access to revolutionary journals. This would allow the Ottoman Freedom Society in Salonika to more effectively spread propaganda throughout the Balkans and to continue to rapidly grow their numbers. Additionally, Dr. Shakir would work hard to merge the Ottoman Freedom Society with the CUP, and after this merger, the two parties would coalesce into a much more coherent and well-organized movement, with agents operating abroad as well as within the empire itself. So, next week, Dr. Shakir and the Young Turks in Exile will unite with Talat and the Ottoman Freedom Society in Salonika. And once this merger is formalized, the revolutionary momentum will become truly unstoppable. So, join me next week as we follow the three masterminds of the revolution, Dr. Nazim, Dr. Shakir, and Talat on their road to 1908. As they put together a coalition ready to take on the Sultan and form the Sacred Committee.